Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be talking to Sloan Rosenthal about why family planning needs to be part of economic stimulus, and how we can fight for expanded Medicaid coverage for family planning. Also, I'll be reviewing a movie that has a shockingly mature approach to abortion, and the unsurprisingly immature insistence that Ted Haggard is really straight. And before I get into the show, I'd like to ask listeners if they could please go to the show's iTunes page and write a review of the show. The more good reviews we get, the easier it is for people searching to find the podcast. And as a thank you for your generosity, I'm going to play an awesome clip of Stephen Colbert making fun of Rush Limbaugh for making fun of feminism.
I cherish Rush's voice, too. That's why he's my ringtone.
Feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society.
So true. It's kind of like what talk radio does for unattractive men.
You're welcome for the belly laughs. And never say that RH RealityCast doesn't treat you right. Oh boy, oh boy, Ted Haggard's finally back in the news cycle. He's got some documentary coming out to promote, and we all win. Because the more we get to see of homophobic right-wing hypocrites who have sex with men, the better, I think. One thing that gets lost a lot in the so-called debate over homosexuality is that the finger-wagging bigots are not the paragons of emotional health they purport to be, but all too often living examples of how the closet is the real danger to your mental health, not homosexuality itself. The Haggards went on Oprah to defend themselves.
I spoke to one of the spiritual leaders. You said what? I'm having these...
I told him I was having... homosexual temptations and thoughts like that, and I needed to process through it. What should I do?
And you think, and do you think you're gay?
No, I don't think I'm gay. I did wonder about that. After this crisis, when I went to therapy, I said, I need to know, am I gay? Am I straight? Am I bi? What am I? And my first therapist said, you are a heterosexual with homosexual attachment.
In other words, a therapist who was paid to say you're straight found a BS heavy way to say you're straight. I feel like Haggard is downplaying the situation dramatically here with the pseudo-psychology talk. Now, I'm not saying if Haggard is gay or straight, but I will say that politicized language from the gay rights struggle describes his situation better than the fake self-help talk that dominates the mainstream evangelical movement. In the closet, describes him much better than homosexual attachments. Let's face it, he didn't just have fantasies. He was having sex with male prostitutes and using meth at the same time. That's not a mere attachment. It is fascinating, though, isn't it, the way that megachurch evangelical Christianity is swamped with psychobabble. I bet a random sampling of 70s-era self-help books compared to a random sampling of modern evangelical texts would show that they sound roughly the same, with the latter just dosing out more judgment. Gail Haggard is being hauled around to talk about how her marriage and sex life is so great despite this, and alas, she's effective at getting people sympathy. The Young Turks were sympathetic, for instance.
She said they have a good sex life, etc., and I believed her, and she was very earnest, and you felt great. I felt great sympathy for her. And she says, look, we really do love each other, and we do have a good sex life, but I get that he's struggling with these urges to do this other thing, right? And I thought it was very understanding for a wife, and that she's stuck with him throughout. But obviously, unless
I found her much more sympathetic.
I don't have any sympathy for her. Just as he's made a career out of selling his sexism and homophobia, she's made a name and a fortune of selling this submissive wife ideal to women. The Stand By Your Man Act is about showing off that she's a perfect wife, submissive to the end, and here she is getting congratulated for it. Which is about reinforcing the message to women that they get rewarded in respect for demeaning themselves before men. Worse for those of us in the audience, the Haggards had to make a big fuss over how great their sex life was, because otherwise you might think Ted Haggard is gay just because he has sex with men, thinks about sex with men constantly, seems to fantasize solely about sex with men, and has done so his entire life. Thus, Gail Haggard had to go on Larry King Live to talk about how much sex she's having with her not-at-all-gay husband.
However, I do think that our sexuality is complex. What I don't like is when we put labels on each other, because I am here to say that 99% of Ted's sexual experiences were with me.
So it's okay to label people as straight and label uncloseted gay people as gay and sinners, but if you're in the closet, suddenly labels are so unpleasant. And sure, 99% of his sex is with you, but what percentage of the great sex that really satisfied him? That's the real question. And maybe he got that with her. Maybe he's bisexual and has a sleazy cheating side. I don't know. But I do know we're getting hoodwinked with this. Gail Haggard may be eliciting sympathy, but she's also spreading two very dangerous and incorrect messages. One is that wifely submission works out well, even if your husband is using drugs and cheating on you with prostitutes. Pretending this is a minor blip in an otherwise ideal marriage is more than a little thwarted, and indicates what levels of horrible treatment that women are told to put up with in these conservative evangelical churches. Also, there's a sexual health issue here that's being completely ignored. Monogamous, tested relationships are considered a safer sex practice, even without condom use. But the religious right promotes marriage as the only safe sex practice. But as this example shows, that isn't always so. I would say that having sex with a man who has been having drug-laced sex with prostitutes is very unsafe, especially if you're not using condoms. And I'm guessing most evangelical couples who think marriage makes you safe skip the condoms. But the possibility of disease isn't even touched, probably because this episode undermines the notion that married sex is automatically safe sex. And with that, I thought I'd end the segment with Roy Zimmerman's song, Ted Haggard is Completely Heterosexual.
Then, 3 weeks later, he's born again, again. Because Ted Haggard is completely heterosexual. Ted Haggard is completely heterosexual. Ted Haggard is completely heterosexual. Glory, how he blew ya.
I'd like to welcome Sloan Rosenthal to the program. Sloan is the Policy Director at National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association, an organization that was active in fighting for a provision in the economic stimulus package that would expand Medicaid contraception coverage. That's been taken out, but Sloan is here to explain what it was and why it needs to come back in a separate bill. Welcome to RealityCast, Sloan.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda.
There's a lot of confusion about what exactly the family planning Medicaid provision was and what it was supposed to do. Can you clarify what the bill actually said before the provision was taken out?
Sure. And this is, I'm going to start with the sort of big focus on who this provision would have affected, and then I'll get into how really commonplace this was and why we were so concerned about it. As you may know, Amanda, there are 17.5 million low-income and uninsured women in America who need access to publicly funded family planning services. And those are people who are of reproductive age, are sexually active, but don't want to become pregnant, and for whatever reason don't have insurance or otherwise can't afford contraception, which out of pocket can cost up to $600 a year for a lot of women, which is a really, for low-income people in America, that's a really unaffordable cost. In many states, for those who are poor enough to qualify for Medicaid already, which in some states is as low as people who are at 12% of poverty, which is a really, for many of us, I think, unthinkably low income level, those people can already get family planning services through the Medicaid program, which is how the government pays for health care for very, very low income people. But for women who are in that sort of gray area, who are low income but are not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, there aren't a vast number of sources of funding that are available to help provide contraceptives for those women. So this provision that was in the stimulus package would have given states the option to provide family planning services to many of those women. specifically to those who whose income levels are up to 185% of the poverty level, or in the state, whatever their eligibility level is for pregnancy-related care. Federal law requires the government to provide pregnancy-related and prenatal care for low-income and uninsured women who become pregnant. And this provision would have said, you know, the state's going to be here for you whether you want to become pregnant or whether you don't. So if you want to prevent an unintended pregnancy, we'll support your contraceptive care, and if you do become pregnant, you know, you'll get the same access to health care. So that's the way the provision would have been targeted. You know, many states already do this through a waiver process. They can apply. It takes about 15 months. 27 states have already expanded access to family planning services through Medicaid in this way. And when I talk about family planning services, I just want to clarify the scope of services we're talking about. It's counseling, sex education, contraceptive care, and preventative health screenings, like breast and cervical cancer, STIs, things like that. So this is really, it's basic reproductive health care, and it's not just access to contraception. It's comprehensive reproductive health care for low-income and uninsured women and families.
On the issue of equality, where we had the government paying for pregnancy-related expenses, but not necessarily for preventing pregnancy, was that inequality there originally because the government was trying to promote childbearing, or was it just an accident?
You know, I don't know that it was a conscious we're trying to promote childbearing. It was, you know, the federal Medicaid statute, which is again how we pay for health care for low-income and uninsured women and men. Has a sort of set of services that states have to cover. And then over time, states have innovated in the Medicaid context and have said, I want to provide coverage for, you know, this set of supplemental services or for this group that's not traditionally eligible. And that's actually how pregnancy care became a part of the standard Medicaid package, was some states had used a waiver process where they apply for permission from the federal government to do it. And it was proven that was an effective way of providing health care to people, and so that then became part of the standard services package. And that's what we're really trying to follow, that same process here. 27 states have already expanded Medicaid coverage of family planning services as a key part of those state Medicaid programs. And those programs have proven that they're effective, that they save money, and that they're an efficient means of providing services to people. And we think those states then shouldn't have to go through that cumbersome waiver process now. They should just be able to take that option to provide those services if they want to.
So can you explain how exactly providing these services could be considered economic stimulus?
Sure. In many states that have already taken this option to expand coverage of family planning services, they've been able to expand clinic hours, to hire new staff. You know, in many of the settings where services are being provided to low-income and uninsured people, the health centers are taking a loss, right? Because they're providing care for free, and you know they're using Title X dollars, they're using state family planning dollars, they're using other grant money to be able to provide care for people, but they're not being reimbursed for providing that care. And Medicaid is an insurance program; it's just like your and my regular health insurance. So when you go see a provider, they fill out a claim form and they get reimbursed for that care. So that new stream of money coming into health centers that are providing family planning services is allowing them to do more with those general operating dollars because they're not spending as much of it providing services that are uncompensated. So they've been able to do things like operate on the weekends or operate at night and early in the morning so that people who are trying to get to their jobs can still go to the doctor. They've been able to expand outreach efforts, which as you may know, you know, when we're talking about low-income and uninsured folks, they don't necessarily have a ton of time to spend thinking about, gosh, what are my options on access to contraception and what's the best method for me? And reaching out to those communities and letting them know services are available costs money. And folks have been able to do that, which takes hiring new people and spending money that gets back into the economy. So that's one of the major ways, is that it really is a job creation mechanism. And then the other reason we think it's important to the stimulus package, and the reason we push so hard to get it in, is states have to balance their budgets. So when tax revenues go down, because property tax revenues are down, income tax rolls are down, people are not making as much money, states have to cut services to balance their budgets. It's a constitutional requirement in most states that they have to balance their budget. And when states have to cut services at the time that more and more people need services because they're losing their jobs, it's worse for everybody. Someone said it's like you have 50 Herbert Hoovers out there in every state government in America, and that's not it's not good for healthcare, it's not good for low-income people, and it's not good for getting the economy going again. So putting dollars back into safety net programs, which in fancy budget speak we call counter-cyclical programs, is really a way to help get the economy going again. And then a whole range of economic experts have said that across the board.
Now that the provision is out of the stimulus package, there's talk of bringing it back as a separate piece of legislation. Do you think this is a good idea? How likely is it to happen, and how likely is it to pass?
You know, I think we're pushing for Congress and the administration to take immediate action on this. I think our priority as the representatives of providers of family planning services to low-income and uninsured men and women is that this provision be enacted into law as soon as possible. And that's where really what we're, I think our rallying cry for folks has been, let's get it done. And let's not focus as much on the nitty-gritty of, you know, the sort of inside Washington game of what vehicle does it go on. We need this done, right? People need access to health care. It's overwhelmingly supported across the board. You know, we use the statistic all the time that 9 in 10 American voters of all political stripes support access to publicly funded contraceptive care for low-income and uninsured people. The National Women's Law Center, our great colleagues we've worked with on this issue, just did a new poll of Republicans and Independents and found that, almost 66% of Republicans and Independents specifically supported increased access to Medicaid-funded family planning services. And those are huge numbers, right? When do 9 in 10 Americans support anything? So I think there's good support across the board in the public, and then we have the largest pro-family planning majority in history in Congress. So I certainly think the prospects are good if we can get to a good place of making the procedural hurdles happen. But we're really focused on just making sure that people that Congress and the administration are hearing how important this is to Americans, how important it is to healthcare providers, and what a really huge issue it is that this get done now.
There's a lot of focus right now on saving money because these packages that we're passing, these bills, are so expensive. And this, according to your institution, is one way to really save a lot of money. Can you talk some about how much money the government would save by investing more in family planning?
Sure. For every dollar that the government spends on publicly funded contraceptive care through Medicaid and also through other federal programs like Title X, they save $4.02 in Medicaid-related pregnancy, labor and delivery, and early childhood care costs for relating to unintended pregnancy. And this goes back to this issue we were talking about earlier that, the government already pays for pregnancy-related care for low-income people who become pregnant. So when you have an unintended pregnancy, that cost gets passed on. So that's where we talk about the cost savings. Those are the dollars we're talking about. And when the Congressional Budget Office looked at what the long-term impact of this provision would be, they found that it would save the federal government $200 million over 5 years and $700 million over 10 years. And that's real money. When we're talking about an $800 billion stimulus package, it's there are a lot of zeros out there, right? But $700 million over 10 years is still a substantial amount of money. And that's just government money. That doesn't even get into the enormous societal cost beyond that of unintended pregnancy.
Our guest today has been Sloan Rosenthal from the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association. You can read more about the organization at nfprha.org. Thank you so much for coming on to RealityCast, Sloan.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda.
Warning, this segment is full of spoilers of the movie Revolutionary Road. A couple of months ago, I did a holiday movie preview segment and said that the movie Revolutionary Road would come out around Christmas. And it did come out then in limited release, but didn't get a wide release until late January. I finally saw it last week because of that, and I have to wonder why it got punted like this when I thought it was the strongest movie I've ever seen from director Sam Mendes. Part of me has to wonder if it's because the plot hinges on an abortion and there's nervousness about that. Not that it's just about abortion. That's why it's such a good movie, because it's about a lot of stuff and abortion is just part of it. In fact, what made it so fascinating is that the abortion functioned both as a symbol of the character's relationship And realistically, as a medical issue that women have to deal with, whether it's legal or illegal. As such, it didn't come across as pedantic, just as is. Here's Kate Winslet talking about the movie.
Revolutionary Road is a beautiful, honest portrait of a marriage. It's set in the 50s in a suburb of New York City. And it's about Frank and April Wheeler, a young married couple who are striving to find the truth in life and to hang on to their marriage and what they had when they once met. And they'll go to any lengths in order to try and rekindle what that once was with some interesting consequences.
Because of all this, it's the most responsible and intelligent portrayal of abortion I've seen on screen in a long time, maybe forever. Since it's set nearly 20 years before Roe v. Wade, the characters who are hostile to abortion feel no need to demagogue about the fetus being a person. No, there's no hiding the truth that abortion offends because it's seen as a physical rejection of a man's power and a sign that a woman is uppity. But it's complicated, too. Here's more from Leonardo DiCaprio, and then again from Kate Winslet.
It's a fascinating portrayal of the human being. When I read the script, I felt like a voyeur, like I shouldn't be in conversations that intimate. And that's a testament to great writing.
It just really struck a chord with me. I think in many ways because I'm very, very different to April. I'm very different to the character that I play. And I just felt so deeply sad for her because there are so many things that she doesn't get to experience in her life. And she doesn't get to realize that many of her dreams. And by comparison, I've been very fortunate.
One way the book differs from the movie is that the book slowly shifts the reader's sympathies from Frank Wheeler to April Wheeler. And by the time April decides to have the illegal abortion that ends her life, you can't blame her because it's indisputable at this point that Frank is constraining and stifling her and that he's using this unintended pregnancy as an excuse to do that. In the movie, you're pretty much on April's side from the beginning, though both characters are fully realized sympathetic human beings.
There have been a number of different projects over the years that we sort of talked about, but we knew it had to be juicy material, and we knew it also had to be vastly different than anything we did in Titanic, and this certainly was it. This was about the disintegration, the dissolving of a relationship, rather than two people sort of fighting to be together against all odds.
One of the great unspoken aspects about abortion that gets lost in all the political chatter and nonsense over it is that for ordinary people who go through this experience, it's often not about the great questions of life so much as the equally great questions of love and family. I blame the anti-choice movement for this. They know it's about family and love and male dominance, but they can't say that because that means that the question of rights is settled forever on the pro-choice side. So they make it about fetal life. And the public buys into that, and people's real feelings about abortion get lost. So I was deeply grateful that this movie centered itself on the real issues, not on fake ones. Abortion is important because it is, or at least can be, a statement on your relationship, on your freedom, and even on your very will to live your life fully. In this movie, it functions as that, and there's no tedious guilt tripping from the producers about the sanctity of fetal life over a woman's life. No, for once, the woman's life is considered the relevant one for the purposes of the story. So go see it. Seriously, Hollywood needs to know that the audience can handle a mature approach to the topic. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Anti-choice means anti-choice edition. Turns out that Bill O'Reilly thinks he should have the right to decide that you should have children that you don't want, but also that you shouldn't have children that you do want.
This story is so outrageous, Ms. Bilchman.
Right.
The state knows the danger the children are in. Now, the state is not doing jack, nothing, doesn't care. At this point, I expect that'll change because public opinion will be demanding a change. The safety of these babies is paramount to the state of California. That's why they're there. That's why this guy has his job, okay? But right now, it's, well, yeah, it happens, so what? Not good enough for me. What do you say?
I stand by waiting for his statements claiming that the Dugar family that has 18 children should have the state intervene. Okay, they're a religious married couple, so apparently I'll be waiting a long time. Look, I think it's highly probable this woman has major mental issues. However, the state can't just a priori decide that the mere act of having 14 children makes you unfit, especially if they are selective and don't shut it down when it's married religious couples. This is a matter of rights, and you can't just start taking people's right to procreate away without it snowballing into a situation where women are declared unfit to procreate because of their race or socioeconomic status. A right doesn't just exist if everyone who uses it can prove they're perfect. Your freedom of speech isn't taken away if you say some of the crazy racist stuff O'Reilly says, nor should it be.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.